Holy cow.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.
Oh my. What fun. Get to talk to all these doctors, man. No wonder I feel good. It's all these doctors to talk to. All right. We're going to have fun now. Talk to Dr. Ray Peet, and it's great to have him on the show again. We've been inviting him about once a month, and he keeps saying yes, so we'll just keep inviting him. And as long as he says yes, we'll do it, because he's just fun to have around and to talk to. He's a renowned nutritional counselor, just renowned. He required a PhD from the University of Oregon with a specialization in physiology, started his work in hormones in 68, wrote his dissertation in 72, where he outlined his ideas on progesterone and hormones closely related to this. His main thesis is that energy and structure are independent at every level. And you can get Dr. Peet's terrific newsletter that we put right on the show page. You can just kind of very nominal fee, and you can get that every couple months and rock and roll and talk to him. Well, Dr. Ray Peet, good morning, sir. How are you?
Very good.
You always sound good, Doc. What'd you have for breakfast this morning?
Coffee and milk and orange juice.
Coffee. I like your breakfasts. It's really good. You know, it's funny. After hanging out with you a little bit of doing these shows, I start thinking about, well, I'm going to try some milk too. I have access to raw goat's milk, and I never did really well with it my whole life, and I'm just doing great with it now after a couple months. And I'm wondering what could change in the body where if I wasn't, you know, able to do even raw goat's milk, and that, you know, this tummy just wasn't happy or elimination, what would change, Dr. Peet, to make it more fun for me now and real fun?
The body is always changing to adapt to circumstances, and they've done experiments with people who thought they were intolerant of lactose,
mm-hmm.
and by introducing an ounce or two or 3 or 4 ounces of milk per day within their tolerance, they found that in a few weeks, even lactose intolerant people, at least the ones that believed they were, for example, uh-huh. I think that was done in San Francisco with Chinese, they found that they were able to drink regular amounts of milk because the enzymes take a couple of weeks to adapt. And that applies to any food. When you change to a different kind of major energy source, your intestine takes weeks to really adjust to it.
Interesting. Yeah. So if you are going to change and maybe introduce something that you haven't for a while, it'd be best to kind of real go just a little bit every day and just kind of let the body know what's going on, kind of thing?
Yeah, you give it signals of what's happening, and it starts making new enzymes to handle the new material.
Yeah.
And that happens most easily when you have all of the essential nutrients in adequate amounts and your thyroid is working efficiently so that you have lots of energy to do the new protein synthesis.
So I'm curious, when you say you drink milk and you drink it, and is milk that good of a food for folks to even consider?
Yeah, the only major deficiency it has is iron, because during pregnancy, high estrogen causes the woman to absorb iron with extreme efficiency.
Hmm.
Several, I think they say 9 or 10 times more efficiently than a man extracting it from food.
Uh-huh.
And that charges up the woman's body with high amounts of iron, and so the baby is born overloaded with iron stores. Their liver stores enough iron for almost a year of life living on milk, and so milk lets them adjust to that newborn state of iron excess. So it's designed to be deficient in iron. And so you can't live indefinitely on just milk. But the estrogen also makes the woman absorb K2 calcium very efficiently because the bones of the baby are going to require lots of calcium. And so milk has an excess of calcium for adult requirements. But it turns out that even in an adult who doesn't need it for growing bones, that excess of calcium turns out to have a very powerful anti-inflammatory, anti-stress effect.
Ah, interesting. I have access to raw cream, too. And boy, man, there's nothing. Holy cow, I don't know if it's good for me, but just to take a big hit of that, you know, like an ounce or two, and just kind of, whoo, it sure feels good.
It really does. If you have good coffee with fresh, heavy cream.
Whoa.
That's delicious.
It's like the real deal. So, and I think that's important, too. I mean, you know, for me and others, if you have a warm milk or a cream or something like that before bed, if it's soothing you and making you feel better and you're happy, I mean, that goes a long way, too, huh?
And during the night, the lack of light causes a developing stress. After about the age of 30, all of the changes related to aging happen during the night because of the stress that requires sleeping to get through it. And the pituitary hormones all zoom up during the night.
Yeah.
You've heard of growth hormone and
sure.
The gonadotropic hormones and mm-hmm. cortisol rising.
Mm-hmm.
The parathyroid hormone rises during the night, and it exacerbates things because it inhibits energy production, which makes you need the cortisol. And the combination of parathyroid hormone and cortisol rising very steeply during the night takes your energy down and breaks down your bones, so morning urine is full of the calcium that you've torn out of your bones during the night.
No kidding.
And so milk at bedtime, experimenters have found that greatly lowers the night stress and
prevents that fascinating?
Some of the surge of those stress hormones.
Maybe that's where the whole idea of that's been around for years, I guess, warm milk at night and all that, maybe that's where that comes from.
Probably
so. Huh? Gandhi did pretty good, and I think if he's on goat's milk, that's kind of lived on. So, what's the difference? Do you know any big difference between goat's milk and cow's milk?
It has several differences. Partly it's because of the goat's favored diet.
Mm-hmm.
They won't
eat everything, right?
Yeah, and they are stubborn and won't eat the stuff they make cows eat.
Yeah.
But basically, it's creamier, and the cream is emulsified in a different way, so it's slower to separate, makes it easier to digest for a lot of people.
Yeah. I was just on a call with the doc, and we were playing around with the blood test just so we could show people how he works with them, and he said I could use some more, you know, fat in my brain kind of stuff, that number was. What could I do to people could get more, make sure we're getting plenty of good fat? What are some foods and some things?
The interesting thing is that babies, if the mother keeps her blood sugar up, the babies make their own fat, which is all saturated, except for the polyunsaturated -9 fatty acids that are synthesized in the baby's liver. And so babies are born with a highly saturated brain, and in that state, in their first few years, when the brain contains only our native polyunsaturated fats and lots of saturated fats, that they have their highest metabolic rate and a tremendous rate of learning. So by the age of 5 or 6, they know 5 or 6,000 words. Imagine an adult trying to learn 5 or 6,000 words in 5 years.
Wow. So we humans, how do we pony up on more of that good fat in our brain?
Sugar, just like a baby.
It's sugar. I like you, boy. It's sugar. Okay.
starch and sugar both turn to fat when you eat enough of them.
Now, what would be the difference between, I don't know, having like a coconut milk ice cream with some sugar, you know, real good sugar, pure cane, organic sugar, and maybe some pork fat, really well-tended pork. I mean, does the brain like them equally?
It actually prefers saturated fat, but since our diets have been industrialized, the pigs now have highly unsaturated fat. For about 50 years, the Department of Agriculture published lists calling pork fat or lard, calling it a saturated fat, but it turned out to be extremely polyunsaturated because they feed them so much soy and corn to make them fat.
Right.
And those polyunsaturated corn and soy oils are highly fattening, where coconut oil is more like natural human fat.
Oh, it is.
And is not so fattening.
Yeah. Boy, you'd love this person. I've been talking to her every week at the farmer's market, and they have pictures, and I've been out there to visit. Doc, that they feed their pigs. You know what they feed them? They get all this food that's thrown away at Whole Foods, mostly vegetables and grass. That's it.
Everyone used to feed their pigs that way when I was a kid.
Yeah.
The creameries would make cheese and give away huge amounts of whey, and the farmers would mix whey with the whatever apple crops or anything that was waste vegetable or fruit, and that was really a kind of ideal diet, milk protein and fruit and vegetables.
Wow. Yeah, and she was saying there's a huge difference between what she's doing out there and these people with these pigs, and like you say, even if you go get some kind of organic pork or something, you don't know what they're feeding them, really. They can be feeding them organic soy and all kinds of stuff, right?
I used to really like pork when I lived in Mexico because the farmers would feed them
vegetables.
That sort of food. Yeah.
And they just eat anything. I've seen a picture of them. They're eating pumpkins. I mean, they'll just eat anything you put in front of them, really. I guess that's why they call pigs. Yeah. But they got a pretty good fat if you get a real nice pig, don't they? Good stuff for us?
When I was a kid, my grandmother a few times sent me to the store to buy some lard for her cooking.
Yeah.
And it, at room temperature, it sat in square cubes, just like butter, nice and solid. But the last time I saw lard in a meat store, it was almost liquid.
Yeah. Just because of the feed, what they feed them, huh?
Yeah.
Here's an email for you, Dr. Ray Pete. Is reduced fat, ultra-filtered milk, lactose-free good to drink? Reduced fat, ultra-filtered milk, I've seen this stuff at the store. Is that good to drink, writes Nancy?
Yeah, it can be if there are no serious additives in it. The lactose, they put an enzyme in that breaks lactose down, and all it does is make glucose and fructose out of the another monosaccharide. I forget what the name of it is, but it's a perfectly good sugar. Makes it taste sweeter.
Is there an issue with drinking even, say, organic grass-fed milk you can now get at the hippie food store that's been homogenized and pasteurized? Is that a real negative for the body?
No, not really.
I'm glad. That's great. So everybody has access if they want to do some moo juice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these days, boy, you have so many choices. Yeah. So do you recommend they'll get folks as high fat as they can in the milk, or does it matter?
No. You can get fat.
Mm-hmm.
I used to drink a gallon a day of, when I was working,
really?
Usually a gallon a day of whole milk, but when I became sedentary going to school, I started getting fat on that, and so I reduced it to 1%, and I could drink a gallon of 1% milk without getting fat.
My goodness.
One of the virtues of milk is that the high calcium content stimulates heat production the same way sodium and protein and sugar stimulate your metabolism, and the calcium is a major factor in maintaining a high metabolic rate.
Yeah, is it the calcium that gets into the little mitochondria in the cells and little energy bunnies, Doc?
Both sodium and calcium stimulate the cell to counteract their stimulating effect, and the rising energy production relaxes the cell, but in the process it burns up a lot of energy.
Yeah. You can check out Dr. Pete's work, raypete.com. How long have you been at this, Dr. Pete?
I got my PhD in 72, and I've been sort of constantly at it, but before that, just seeing particular needs. Already in the 50s, I was offering my advice to people.
Yeah. Wow. And you're a bit of a contrarian, aren't you, in a way, because of the research that you do? I mean, if I had a dollar for every person who's been on the show in the last 12 years that said, well, humans are not made to drink milk after weaning. You know, I mean, it's that meme is out there.
That is a very popular...
That's a popular thing to say, right?
Yeah. And like mainline medicine, there's a sort of mainstream counterculture that has ideas like that. And naturopaths and chiropractors have lots of counterculture ideas, but a lot of those are wrong too.
Yeah, and they just keep getting repeated over and over, don't they? Over and over and over and over. What are some of the things that you know that folks can do more of? Because one of the biggest ideas that the doctors, natural or otherwise, are being presented with is low energy. Talk a bit about that. I mean, that's the number one complaint when people go to the doctor. I just want more energy.
Mostly that turns out to be a low thyroid state, and that relates to a lot of things that have become more problematic in the national diet over the last 50 years. But even in the 30s and 40s, there were people who were in a position to see a lot of problem patients, and they were estimating that probably 40% of the population was practically hypothyroid, suffering some symptoms of hypothyroidism. And since then, the diet has deteriorated. So using those same standards, you could say that probably 60 or 80% of the people are suffering from hypothyroidism, but the standards for measuring it since the 1940s have changed to revise the definition of normal, so that people have stayed normal by their tests despite the changing circumstances. And it turns out that the standard they use for diagnosing hypothyroidism is TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone made by the pituitary. And what they overlook is that the stress caused by hypothyroidism and bad diet, the stress hormones lower TSH the same way an excessive thyroid hormone would. And so a stressed, tired, low-energy person will have a very low TSH production because of the stress hormones. The doctor's looking at it.
Wow, you're good.
Yeah, and quite a few people have had a diagnosis of hyperthyroidism because their TSH is so low, but then their symptoms such as water retention, fatigue, and so on, hair loss, they're diagnosed by those as hypothyroidism. So several people have told me, I'm both hyperthyroid and hypothyroid. Makes absolutely no sense, but quite a few doctors are actually saying that.
They're saying it now. So on the whole panel on the thyroid, is there which marker do you kind of look at that think people should pay attention to if they, you know, if they want to kind of dig into this a bit?
It's good to look at all of them, mm-hmm. but the free T3 and free T4 and TSH, each of those is ambiguous under stress. Oh. And so the ones I look at mostly are, is there hemoglobin and hematocrit up to normal? Is there cholesterol above normal?
Mm-hmm.
Two or three little metabolic indicators like that. How are the liver enzymes? Those going a little bit off-center are typical of high thyroid people. And so you have to take those into account. And their temperature and heart rate
mm-hmm.
are mm-hmm. pretty good indicators. The real indicator that was abandoned after the pharmaceutical companies took over in the 40s, they used to measure actual oxygen consumption and heat production, or calorie use. And if a person was only burning two-thirds as much energy as a healthy person, not to mention the extra-vital people who burned 20 or 30% more than average, those people were given a thyroid supplement to bring their oxygen consumption up to normal, and their symptoms went away. Their cholesterol went down, temperature came up, heart rate was normalized, blood pressure came down if it was high, came up if it was low. So looking at oxygen consumption and calorie consumption, a person just by keeping their own records of what they're eating and drinking
mm-hmm.
Can get a good impression of their calorie consumption. Women who diet a lot, they have been found, instead of the textbook 1,700 calories per day that used to be published, they were found to be able to maintain their weight on 700 calories a day because of low thyroid function.
Fascinating. So it's fair to say, and I guess we can't even quantify, of what it is when folks worry or stressed out and have angst and such, and to know what it's really doing with the body, but it certainly changes a lot of things. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and low thyroid people chronically have anxiety because when your energy production goes down, it happens to everyone during the night. It compensates with increased adrenaline and cortisol to counteract the stress of low thyroid. But when your thyroid is chronically low, you run around in the daytime with elevated adrenaline mm-hmm. and cortisol.
Cortisol, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen people with several times the normal amount of adrenaline production. And even where that would make a normal person seem very agitated and anxious, some people can function normally with four times as much adrenaline production as normal.
Oh, my goodness. And that's why some low thyroid people tend to sometimes get anxious or AFib and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and especially at sunset when the stress hormones are normally rising, a low thyroid person can go into a very anxious, worrying state chronically. Every night they start worrying.
So you mentioned that's why we sleep, because the stress hormones come out. Why do they come out at night?
Experiments on rabbits in Leningrad, they found that as soon as the lights were turned out, the mitochondria started swelling a little.
Wow.
The nights there in the winter are about 16
sure.
hours long.
Yeah.
So halfway through the night, the mitochondria were extremely enlarged. About 3 or 4 in the morning, they started exploding and collapsing and stopping energy production altogether. And they found that generally at the end of winter, because of these very long nights, their mitochondria had been seriously deteriorated. The way an old person's mitochondria are, the DNA is lost, for example. But because their summer days are extremely long. Rabbits and people have more opportunity to restore their mitochondria. And certain kinds of exercise in old people can do the same thing that very long days do for rabbits and people in Leningrad. You can restore even the DNA, the few surviving mitochondria with good DNA will multiply quickly under prolonged light and good exercise. In humans, there was a study in which they put a tube in their arm so they could take a blood sample every 15 minutes during the night, and they found that when they turned the lights out, within 15 minutes, there was a rise in cortisol, which continued giving them an extremely high morning cortisol. But the ones who went to sleep, the rise was much slower than if they stayed awake. So sleep is a way of reducing our need for cortisol.
I see. And we've been told over the years that it's really good to sleep and get early, and that's really more beneficial than going to bed at 1, 12, or 1 or 2 o'clock. Do you think there's something to that?
Yeah, people who have spent the summer months in Antarctica, where the daylight is constant, have said they felt the best of their lives, didn't feel any of that nighttime stress. Getting to sleep early so that you're minimizing the stress of nighttime is very helpful to the body.
Yeah. Speaking of light, we've been doing some research and people are talking more about it, these near-infrared lights. Do you have any opinions on the possible beneficials of some of these things?
Infrared is basically heat, and it's good to help keep your metabolic rate up just by staying warm.
Yes.
Like old people sleep better if they wear a wool hat and wool socks at night, or even take a warm bath before bed. But the warming effect is one thing, but different wavelengths of infrared penetrate differently.
Right.
Most of it is just warming the water, and so it's highly absorbed by your tissue. Red light at the fairly narrow band from orange to red is not absorbed by most of the things in the tissue. It passes right through water without heating it, but when it runs into a blue protein, blue enzyme, which we have quite a few of those containing copper that makes them blue, under stress, the free radicals and free electrons reduce that blue copper, turn it red, and the red light being absorbed by those copper-containing enzymes changes the state, reoxidizes the copper. It favors oxidized and oxidizing state of the copper rather than the reduced state. That puts the mitochondria back to work because the copper enzymes are the final enzyme of the mitochondrial energy producing system.
So are you saying then some of these red lights can be beneficial?
They can within just a minute or two restore the enzyme activity, and they've measured rats' cognitive ability and oxygen consumption in their brains just shining red light through their head. It restores their mitochondrial oxidation very quickly.
And then it'll continue on its own for a bit without the light?
It has a certain momentum before the stress knocks
cool.
it out again.
Very cool.
So about every 10 or 15 minutes, having a little flash of light on your body would probably help.
You'd almost put a red light thing on your bed and put it on a timer or something like that. Might be fun. We're hearing a lot between this, I think, 600 to 800 nanometer range of the infrared lights. Do you think there's some some value in that kind of idea of working with those things?
Yes, 600 to 700 yeah. Mm-hmm. Is the most important band.
Mm-hmm. Can you put that in your eyes as well? Shine in your eyes?
Yeah, there were experiments with, for example, welders who burned their eyes with ultraviolet light
mm-hmm.
Were found to have instant pain relief almost when they looked at red light.
Oh.
And experimenters with deadly amounts of gamma rays that would kill a frog from radiation sickness in the first few hours after exposure, just a gigantic dose. When they gave them red light immediately after the radiation, it didn't kill them.
My goodness.
It had the same effect on the electrons, which had been knocked out of their proper condition by the gamma rays. The red light restored the enzymes that would have led to fatal inflammation.
Cool. Dr. Ray Peet, stay right there, sir. We're going to just do a quick little break. Boy, it's fun talking to him, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how he knows all this stuff. It's an honor to have Dr. Peet here. His website is raypeet.com. He has a very fairly priced, very, very fair. It's not much at all. He can tell you in every couple months he does a nice newsletter. You can sign up for that one on raypeet.com. We're going to get to some of your emails. We've got more coming in, but go ahead and get them in now, and we're going to jump through as many as we can here. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. We got our hydrogen machine yesterday. I was able to get one because we sold some and through the commissions with George Wiseman, who has been working with these things for about 30 years and more. There's some really cool things going on with hydrogen gas and hydrogen bubbling your water. We'll see how, you know, what my experience is. I haven't put it together yet, but I'm going to do that this afternoon, and we'll be here tomorrow, and I've got some real interesting things to talk to you about on what I discovered and how I created a situation where a little bug can go on my tummy from the spiritual level, and I think you'll find it interesting. That's tomorrow on Open Phone Friday at 9 o'clock. And here's George talking about George.
This was previously with George Wiseman about his AquaCure machine making hydrogen, gas, and water out of the same hose. Listen.
The body accepts that gas and uses it to heal everything. It's like the fountain of youth. It's astonishing the amount of ailments. In fact, in scientific studies, and they have over 1,000 scientific studies now, they are showing that it either helps the body heal directly or indirectly from virtually every ailment that ails any water-based life form. But it works just as well on animals and plants and lizards and birds and everybody.
And you're saying this because this machine called the AquaCure split into 5 different parts.
6.
I got hydrogen, oxygen, electro, enhanced water, water vapors, monatomic hydrogen. What else?
And monatomic oxygen.
Oh, the monooxygen. And that's what your machine does? It splits it?
Yes, it makes that mixture inside the machine, and all that comes out a single hose. The same hose.
A gas?
As a gas, in gaseous form, yes.
And you breathe it or you put it in water?
So if you bubble the Brown's gas into this water,
yeah,
into, let's say, distilled water, it will go to a negative ORP. And when you drink that, it actually gives your body an electrical energy, these electrons. Instead of sucking energy from you, it gives it. So you can have water that is healthful and not healthful just by the energy that's in the water.
You want to get one? Me too. Ours is on the way. Check this out. Lifetime warranty on the machine itself, and then a 1-year, no questions asked, money back guarantee if you like the machine within a year. I mean, have you ever heard of a warranty like that? The AquaCure. Use promo code OneRadio. Promo code OneRadio for a 10% discount. It's in our store on OneRadioNetwork.com. Pretty fun, huh? So we'll see. And lots of questions about it. And actually, Dr. Mark Circus, on his website, he's going to be back in a couple of weeks. He's really into the hydrogen thing, has been for 30 years. And he's got a lot of information on it. And you can go there, too, and read his stuff. And then if you want to get one, come back to our website, please, and order it through our store. We have the Elk Velvet on sale right now. Known to remind you from Daniel Vitalis. And also, if you would like to help your sleeping, You could check out Ken Rolla's Scalar Energy Device. It is the Golden Pyramid, and it has put out scalar waves about 10, 15 feet. Put one of these puppies like on your headboard, you know, on your bedstand, and it's a beautiful little golden pyramid, and it helps people sleep. It just helps a lot, and I think you'll enjoy it. Or even at night, if you spend a lot of time in your living room reading or something, you could put one in there too. And the Scalar Energy Device, as well as the water or the structuring device, is in our store, and it's called the Vitalizer Plus. Great thing to structure water with. Helps your body to absorb better water. And I don't wonder how that's going to go. I could do structure the hydrogen water. I don't know. Well, we'll play with it. And it's all on OneRadioNetwork.com in our store.
Know the source. One Radio Network.
We're talking with Dr. Ray Pete, who's been at this forever, a long, long time. Dr. Pete, this is interesting. A lady just sent an email, and she says, I fall asleep and sleep well with my chicken light shining on me. Oh, that's that red kind of chicken light thing.
Yeah, it looks like an ordinary incandescent bulb,
mm-hmm.
but they're designed to run on 130 volts, so on 120 standard voltage, they're less blue-oriented. They're richer in the red light, and so I have one over my head all the time.
Do you really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't get too warm? Does it have to be very close?
No, about 3 feet over my head, but in the winter,
yeah.
I use two of them.
Yeah.
They help warm the room,
yeah.
But it's always a beneficial anti-stress light to be going right through your skin into your head.
But these would be different. Is it just a different technology or strength? Or you tell me, please, the difference between those, you know, chicken lamp things you can get at Home Depot and the bulb, not very expensive. Some people are even putting them 4 or 5 in a row and making a little sauna out of them, or some of these more expensive 600 to 800 far infrared things. I mean, is there beneficial to the more juicy or the more souped up ones?
No.
No.
The $5 ones are fine.
Yeah.
They used, because they were designed for the higher voltage,
mm-hmm.
they used to burn forever on standard 120 volts,
but uh-huh.
I think now that the demand for them has increased, they've learned how to make them burn out like an ordinary light bulb, so you have to buy a new one.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to an engineer that made a beautiful little thing where there's 4 of them, and you can get it, and we're gonna be selling it on our website. So Dr. Pete says they're just as good as the more expensive ones, and you could put one and do a little sauna or just kind of, you know, sit in front of it. You know, Dr. Pete, I've got about 3 of them on a chair, you know, one of those big black things where you can hook them on a chair. And as you said, in the winter, if I'm reading or watching a movie, I like to shine those on me. And it's really comforting, isn't it? They're very nice. Yeah.
Yeah, and even with serious neurological diseases, they can help restore mitochondria.
Uh-huh. This is an email from Jerome. He is in Germany. Well, hi, Jerome. It's probably 7 o'clock in the, or 6 or so, in Germany. He says, I'm about 65 revolutions around the sun. As Patrick says, I'm in very good health, but I do have some numbness, toes, my feet sometimes, and it just feels numb, like the circulation is not going well. Can Dr. Pete give me some ideas what could be going on and what could be some remedies?
I think with age, one of the things becomes chronic inflammation.
From
slow digestion.
Oh.
And the intestine not only releases its inflammatory signals into the bloodstream, but the nerves that pass through the pelvic area,
mm-hmm.
I think, are being poisoned by the intestine emits some of these serotonin, histamine, nitric oxide, endotoxin substances out into the general pelvic area, and so it can affect the way the bladder works, tends to slow down the muscle contraction,
mm-hmm.
And it can also poison the nerves as well as the blood vessels passing through the pelvis.
Very interesting.
And slow down the nerve and circulation energy production,
mm-hmm.
in the legs and feet.
Wow, very interesting. So let's go back to the cause of that. What kind of things can
can Jerome do?
The accumulation of polyunsaturated fats in the tissue means that any particular inflammation, for example, a green salad isn't digestible by humans, and so it feeds bacteria, and the bacteria will produce various things that activate the signals of inflammation, and the more polyunsaturated fat you have stored in your tissues, the more inflammatory prostaglandin, especially PGE2, will be produced, and that circulates through the body as it only goes a certain distance in the blood, but it creates these cascade effects of one thing stimulating another. So cutting your polyunsaturated fats or using aspirin chronically, the aspirin will block the formation of prostaglandins and reduce that amplifying effect.
So the aspirins would be a negative thing, right? The aspirin would be a negative thing.
No, it helps to block that amplifying of the inflammation. It blocks prostaglandin formation.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Hmm.
So, Jerome, could he even try that? I mean, just like a bear aspirin, how much would you take, or a little baby aspirin?
Enough to make the symptoms go away is the basic thing. And if you're going to do it chronically, especially if you have used antibiotics and disturbed the intestinal bacteria, chronic use of aspirin can cause abnormal excess bleeding. And so you want to make sure your diet has some vitamin K in it. When I was first experimenting with chronic use of aspirin, I noticed that if I scratched myself slightly, I would leave drops of blood for about 20 or 30 minutes afterwards. So I took vitamin K, and now I can take
a little bit of aspirin.
Yeah, 1,000 milligrams a day doesn't cause any bleeding abnormality.
Just because you're taking the K?
Yeah.
The K, is that K2 or just K?
Our liver can make the whole range of
Okay, just...
So, yeah, if you eat liver, two or three times a month,
you're good.
You get the range of K1, 2, and various others.
Boy, you're not the, as you know, the only person that recommends folks do a little liver a couple times a month. It's really beneficial for most people. Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Here's an email from Carol. Does Dr. Pete, do you prefer certain types of protein powders?
No, powdering protein, most proteins contain two or three amino acids that are very unstable. When they break down, they can produce inflammatory toxins. The indoles made from tryptophan, for example, are age-related and stress-related toxins. And if you oxidize a normal protein, you will get some breakdown of the unstable amino acids. Cysteine and tryptophan are the worst for breaking down in processing. So the only protein that doesn't have these unstable amino acids is gelatin. So nicely made, clean gelatin can be powdered.
Gelatin? Oh, you mean you're just talking about gelatin from the store?
Yeah.
That's protein.
It isn't a complete protein for a growing animal, but an adult who isn't growing has a very small requirement for tryptophan, methionine, and cysteine. And if you reduce an adult animal, reduce the methionine alone in its diet, experiments have found a 40% extension of their lifespan just by that one protein being reduced to a minimum maintenance requirement. I think you'd get better results reducing the cysteine and tryptophan at the same time, which gelatin would do.
Gelatin. Well, here's an interesting, it ties right in, so let's see.
let's see, it's kind of long. I'm going to paraphrase. Judy says she talked to somebody on YouTube, Dr. Gray, and talked about Parkinson's, and he said that he helped with a few things, and she's been doing it and actually sleeping better. She's taking a little bit of tyrosine, cysteine, and 5-HTP for potential Parkinson's and to sleep. Does Dr. Pete think this could be, is a good idea?
No, I don't think the 5-HTP is good at all.
Okay.
It can lead to increased inflammation.
Oh, it just does. How about the cysteine, the tyrosine?
It produces inflammation and can damage mitochondria.
Oh, good. Tyrosine?
I think it's okay, but not too much of it.
What does it do? Why would just take a little bit?
Well, it leads to adrenaline, for example, and in moderation, that isn't harmful.
Okay. Why would you take it, though, if you're not doing the other ones? Do you think that she would get the results that she wants?
A little bit of it isn't harmful, and it can have a slightly stimulating effect if you're somewhat low in protein. But gelatin, for example, has a generous amount of the precursors to adrenaline and dopamine.
Yeah, this just popped in. We might as well say it while it's here. Ken says, so where do I get this gelatin Dr. Pete is talking about? It sounds interesting.
There are two companies I know of that have a good, clean product. Great Lakes Gelatin is an old company from the 1920s or 30s. I think they were selling medical gelatin.
We know them, yeah.
Great Lakes. And I think Innovation Products, something like that, is the name of the other one I've used. I got it by an 80-pound bag, I think it was.
Wow. You can take a lot of it. You can take a lot of it.
Yeah. 30 grams a day is fine.
Now, the Great Lakes, they offer the red can and the green can. I think the green is a little bit more processed. Does it matter to you, Dr. Pete?
No, I haven't used much of it, but I don't think there's any harm in using the soluble one.
Oh, they mean the green is a green label soluble?
Easier to dissolve without so much stirring and heating.
So just basically, the body likes this kind of a protein.
The adult body.
The adult body likes more than all these other things that they sell out there, these pea proteins, all that stuff?
Yeah, those all have toxic breakdown products when they're dehydrated.
Oh, great.
Okay. Same with liver powder. You can't safely dehydrate liver.
Here's an email. Dr. Pete, my blood glucose level came back at 127. The normal range says 70 to 99, so I guess he's talking about the fasting blood glucose. Should I be concerned? All other chemistry readings were in the normal range.
I wouldn't be concerned, but you should pay attention to things like your temperature and pulse rate, and watch your cholesterol if you have a blood test, in the long range, it will probably come down when your thyroid function is optimal.
Mm-hmm. When you say the pulse rate, talk a bit about that.
When your adrenaline rises to compensate for low thyroid, it prevents the very, very slow pulse rate of hypothyroidism in the classical sense. And often a person waking up in the morning when their cortisol is high, they will sometimes have a racing heart, which slows to normal after breakfast. That's because of the high stress hormones during the night. So either very high in the morning pulse rate or very low during the day. I've seen people as low as 35 beats per minute who are still getting around, usually very sluggish and depressed, sometimes as a result of overtraining. But heavy training lowers your thyroid and metabolic rate. The healthy, high IQ kids in some studies all had around an 85 beats per minute pulse rate. Some studies on older people found that like the high school age kids, the pulse rate varied with their IQ. Very low thyroid tired people have a lower mental functioning. So they had people who had had heart implants, and so they gave them a mental test, sit with the heart set at 70 beats per minute, then turned up the stimulator to produce 85 beats per minute, and all of their mental functions, ability to calculate and reason and memory, increased just by turning up the rate of the artificial heart stimulator.
Fascinating. So as folks' thyroid get more in balance for them, generally they're going to increase their pulse rate a bit.
In the range of 80 to 90, I think, is good for most people.
That's amazing. Dr. Pete?
And that tends to go with a stable blood sugar, usually around 90, and a stable blood pressure, usually roughly in the range of 120 over 80.
Mm-hmm. Boy, mine's been 60 pulse rate for 50 years, I think. If I got to 80 or 90, I'd probably... I don't know. It would feel not good to me. So I'm kind of confused.
The first week or two that you supplement thyroid, if you're running around keeping your heart rate going with adrenaline, the first thing you feel is that the thyroid is like speed. It makes you anxious and tense. That's a typical reaction to the first days. But if you go very slow, like a fourth of the standard dose or less, do that daily for several weeks, you'll find that your pulse is slowing down and your temperature slightly creeping up. When you are fully oxidizing, the energy production from the high oxidizing function of the mitochondria, that has a relaxing effect on your nerves and muscles. Your muscles will instantly be able to go into a relaxed state, and sleep will come on very quickly because your brain quickly goes into the deep sleep. A low thyroid person typically, when they measure the brain waves, they aren't able to get into the deepest levels of sleep, and so sleep isn't restful.
Very, very, very interesting. So you have people even start maybe 15 of those milligrams of a 60 caps thyroid thing and just kind of juice it up a little bit. So then eventually would then the pulse rate go up a little bit, but do it normally, not on adrenaline, but because your thyroid is working better, is what you're saying?
Yeah, gradually as your temperature and oxygen consumption increase. One of the first things that happens in the first hours or even minutes after taking a thyroid supplement is that your cells begin making more energy, and they're able to retain magnesium in the cell because magnesium binds to ATP. Low thyroid person is breaking down the ATP because there's not enough magnesium to stabilize it.
Wow.
And if you don't have a good reserve of magnesium somewhere in your body, increasing the thyroid runs into a wall where there's not enough magnesium, and so it does nothing but increase stress. So making sure you're getting enough magnesium is essential when you're adjusting the thyroid.
And what's a reasonable dose to look at daily of mag?
In the first two or three days, it's okay to take a gram or two of magnesium carbonate, but just having a good diet. Coffee is rich in magnesium, milk, orange juice, meat and fish.
Oh, good.
All of those are good magnesium sources.
Is magnesium glycinate okay? I've got some of those.
Yeah,
good?
It is.
Yeah, it's good. Wow. How'd you figure all this stuff out?
What?
How'd you figure all this stuff out? I'm just amazed, you know. It's like, whoa.
A professor at University of Colorado did the experiments on magnesium.
I see.
And a doctor friend tested it on his patients, found that giving a combination of T3 thyroid and magnesium IV instantly relieved his allergy patients. But when they got the magnesium with the thyroid, it kept them out of the allergic state. It cured the allergy instead of just temporarily relieving it.
My God. The T3 a lot different, straight TV. T3 is a lot different from just your standard piggy thyroid and the 60 milligram things that they sell.
And it works within actually seconds if you chew up a 2 or 3 micrograms of it. But it, if you just swallow a pill, it works maximally an hour and a half after you swallow a pill, and then it fades off, losing half of its activity in the first 12 hours. So it isn't something you can take once a day, because you would have very sharp ups and downs.
Yeah,
that's why the glandular powder is better.
Ellen writes in, can Dr. Pete recommend a brand of Chlorella that he likes better than others? Chlorella?
No, I wouldn't touch it myself.
How come?
All of those organisms have some irritating components, but sometimes the growth in the lake can become contaminated with a toxic version.
Oh.
So I think it's always risky.
Yeah. Spirulina, same caution? Spirulina, same cautionary tale for that.
Uh-huh.
Mitchell is writing in, I wonder if you could ask Dr. Pete about hammer toes. Do you know anything about hammer toes?
Not really. I think it probably involves some of the same inflammatory things that affect the nerves and blood vessels of the feet, but I've never experimented on anyone with it.
Okay. Gio, that's a nice name. I was wondering if you could ask Dr. Pete about bloating. It seems to be caused by sugar. Methylene blue, sometimes help. Does he have any advice?
Slow digestion. And when you have bacteria living where they shouldn't, they should stay in the colon. But when your digestion is poor and slow, they can move up. A very hypothyroid person sometimes has bacteria and yeast living in the stomach. You've heard of the stomach cancer and ulcers being caused by bacteria living there. Various microorganisms can occupy the upper parts of the intestine. And when you have bacteria in the small intestine, they will eat anything that they contact. So sugar, which should be absorbed very quickly in your stomach and very early part of the upper intestine, the bacteria can get to it before you can absorb it. So sugar can very quickly produce gas. Ordinarily, the slower digesting vegetables with starches that are intertwined with fibrous cellulose-type material, lignans, those are the things that normally cause bloating and feed bacteria in the lower small intestine. Beans, even in the colon, the fibrous material in beans very commonly will cause gas, but other vegetables, if your digestion is slow. So the first thing is to accelerate the transit of your food, and thyroid is the main thing behind that energetic quality of the intestine.
So you're talking about this whole SIBO thing that people talk a lot about, this small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you ask Dr. Pete his information on what taking turpentine would do to the stomach acid overall? Have you heard people doing turpentine?
Oh, yeah, since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
You would put a drop on a sugar cube, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah, so you know and about that, yeah.
I always loved painting with turpentine as the solvent. I like the smell of it. And I think it's basically harmless. If you look at the internet, you'll see thousands of
sure,
warnings
we've done shows
about
on,
toxicity.
Yeah.
But
it's harmless, yeah.
Yeah, you can become very allergic to it, and so you'll know if you're allergic to it. And it's the same with the citrus thinners that they're selling to replace turpentine. They can become extremely allergenic, especially if they're aged.
And if you're hearing this for the first time, you want to make sure that you're using like pure gum spirits of turpentine and not the, you know, just an old can off of Home Depot. Just get the real deal. And we have one at a store that's just pine trees. That's all they do. They just sap it and cook it. Yeah.
Some of the companies are selling stuff in their old pure gum spirits, pine turpentine cans, and it turns out to be gasoline.
Oh, my goodness.
Selling it for $25 a gallon instead of $3
so
and a half.
So be careful. I would do the Diamond G Forest products. You can go on Amazon, or I think we have it on our store still, Diamond G Forest products. We've talked to those people. They just tap a pine tree, they take out the sap, and they cook it. That's all they do. That's it. Just pretty cool. Stay right there, Dr. Pete. We have more questions for you. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. It's so interesting. Dr. Pete mentioned the bacterial overgrowth thing, and I've been playing around with Wayne Blakely's Bifido 2. Now, the Bifido is a very cool thing with the curcumin from India, where you can get the little yttrium. They got some very nice special bacteria in there that helps the yttrium to get released. And that's one of the reasons why Richard Olry and other people have said that the yttrium doesn't get released much in the horse soil because the bacteria is not there. So that's curious. But you can get the Bifido too, and you can put this in your ears. I've been doing it every night. My body likes it, and you can put it in each ear and then bend over, then hold the ear, do the other ear, and then you can also use the Bifido 2 in your eyes, along with Flora PM in your eyes, just a drop or two. And I'm getting gooey stuff coming out of my eyes like every day. It's like crazy. And it looks like it's trying to just clean up a little scarring on the eyes, a little bit of fat, or I'm not sure where the gooey stuff's coming from, but I like it, and my eyes are getting clearer and brighter, and just using it in the eyes over a couple of weeks. Pretty interesting. So these are a couple of things you can play with if you're interested in Living Streams, the Bifido 2 or the Bifido, and that's it. Previously, we talked with Brandon Amalani about his Blue Shield product to protect against EMFs in your home.
The more connected we are, the more electromagnetic radiation we're going to have. So years ago, I'd play with Q-Links and just anything I can get my hands on that, whether I felt it working or not, I just wanted some kind of leverage against electromagnetic radiation and those frequencies and how they affect the cellular biology. But then when I met Mark and started really getting deep to his technology and really looking at the microprocessing technology, I've never found any EMF company that would not only to test on not only human blood and urine analysis, but also on animals, which totally weeds out the idea of placebo effect. I mean, the fact that you can plug these devices into a chicken farm, a factory farm, for about 15,000 laying hens, and all of a sudden the mortality rate, which is averages from 60 to 150 deaths per month, goes down to zero. I mean, it's pretty profound that a little device, a little energy device, could actually like create such a harmony and balance within the environment to where claustrophobic chickens that are crammed in together actually get along better and actually feel better, and the biological markers are improved over that 1 year study.
There's quite a bit of science with this Blue Shield product. You can see the ad on the front page. Promo code OneRadio will get you a 10% discount. This works on the cells in the body. Very cool technology. Front page, Blue Shield, OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with Brandon Amalani of Shen Blossom, talking about our very special ginseng.
And you don't want something that's been corrupted coming into your body, like the ginseng is a super important example of that. You know, when you're using aggressive alcohols and solvents, it has a strange effect with ginseng, in the sense that when you're not only over processing it, but putting it in really aggressive alcohols, what's going to happen is that you're going to flip the chemistry on some of the androgenic. Naturally, it's androgenic. It's going to basically protect the telomeres and add life to the body and protect the genetic replication of the cells. But it's also going to boost the androgens and boost the male hormones in the body. But if you incubate it in really aggressive alcohol, it flips those to become estrogenic. Now, estrogens, phytoestrogens, are not necessarily bad in balance, but you really don't want that with your ginseng, especially if you're getting like really high quality, a really old root, something that's very special. You want to like treat it with care and make sure it's delivering what ginseng has to offer.
Just a short clip from Brandon talking about the way they do the ginseng, just to give you a better idea of where this company is coming from, the quality and the ethics. Brandon and the Shen Blossom link on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Yeah, I like that line a lot. And, well, we do what we can here, and just trying to provide as much different opinions and ideas. And this morning is one of our faves, and we appreciate you coming on, Dr. Pete, from time to time. Dr. Ray Pete, his website, raypete.com. This one, Leslie, I'm getting so much different information on the internet about iodine. Some people are taking massive doses. Some people say you don't need it. And I wanted to what Dr. Pete says, in general, do you think I should be taking iodine every day?
No. Milk, for example, is a good source of iodine because the cows won't give milk if they're iodine deficient. Chickens will stop laying eggs if they're iodine deficient. So milk and eggs are guaranteed sources of iodine. Seafood, any kind of ocean fish, oysters, crab, cod, whatever, is going to provide enough iodine along with the associated selenium, which is an essential nutrient for thyroid function.
Can we get enough selenium with Brazil nuts and other foods?
Those are fine.
Good. Here's an email. After taking digestive aid without lots of quality foods at it, and curious of his thoughts on that one. I don't know what she means by that. Without lots of quality foods. Does he suggest soaking? Oh.
Digestive aids like pancreatic enzymes can be extremely helpful. But yeah. You want to watch that they aren't made from just a fungus. If they're including a lot of strange enzymes, they're probably from a fungus, and they can contain allergens, so you want to be cautious. Some people can have very intense reactions to them.
Can you, and she wants to know if you can put some foods in an enzyme solution to see if it digested. Is that a reasonable experiment?
Not really. There were experiments with the pancreatic enzymes and stomach acid. In a test tube, they found that they were extremely slow when they mixed up a protein with acid and the pancreatic proteinases. But when they added, they took a piece of intestine, fixed it with formaldehyde, so it was totally dead, but dropped this fuzzy piece of intestine lining into the solution of acid, enzyme, and protein, and suddenly the reaction went at top rate. It's because the enzymes in a free solution don't contact the proteins that they're supposed to digest, but if they're laid out in the proper arrangement on the fuzzy lining of the intestine, that's where the any substrate protein tends to fall against this flat surface, be bound, absorbed to the surface, and then you get instantaneous protein digestion. A baby, for example, in the very first few months does assimilate protein from the liquid phase, but with maturation, the lining of the intestine becomes at least 90% of the digestive activity for proteins.
Wow. What sorts of progesterone would Dr. Pete suggest I use if I want to take progesterone?
The kind that I designed and have been using for
really?
About 50 years was Progest E complex. It's a progesterone in the oily solution that I found works well through the skin as well as orally.
Progest E. Can people buy that? Did you?
Kinogen is the maker of it that has been following my formula for 40 years.
Ketogen. And
K-E-N-O-G-E-N.
Oh, Kinogen, like mm-hmm. Kino. So what's the source of that? Is it the yam stuff?
It can vary. I don't know what the company, it's an American company that makes the actual progesterone, but I don't think it matters at all what the original material was, because there are about 20 chemical reactions in between the yam and the progesterone.
Would our men listening this morning, is there any reason why they might look at progesterone too?
The stress hormones will cause testosterone to be turned to estrogen very quickly.
Right.
And that's why testosterone declines with aging as estrogen rises. And getting the stress hormones down, progesterone and pregnenolone are the two main things for stopping the formation of estrogen from testosterone. So a large dose of progesterone will have an anti-androgen effect. If you take like 100 milligrams, you can notice a temporary neutralizing of testosterone, but at small doses, its only effect is to free up the natural functions of testosterone by blocking the stress conversion to estrogen.
Wow. Uh-huh. But you don't want to just take too much of that. It takes a little bit.
I've taken 100 milligrams. Twice I did that for a migraine headache, and the headache stopped within a 1 or 2 minutes. But the following day, I didn't have any whisker growth.
That's funny. So your testosterone wasn't happy.
Totally neutral.
But I guess on that company you mentioned, they probably dose it out pretty cleanly and tell you what to take.
No. You can't overdose if you use it only on your skin.
Right, and so this is a cream, this Kinogen thing?
An oil.
It's an oil. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
You can't overdose if you do it on there.
But not orally. You can overdose orally.
I see. So. Here is an email. Can you tell us more about the protein content and vitamin C content of potatoes? The question is from a couple of people who think a day without a potato is an incomplete day. That's funny. So, do you know about potatoes? Can you talk about that protein?
There were studies in the Pacific Islanders. They found that they were eating nothing but potatoes for 50 or 51 weeks of the year, and then at the end of the year, they had a festival where they would eat pork. But they were very healthy, well-muscled people, 50 weeks of the year, pure potato diet. So they did experiments and found that potatoes, by analysis, they seemed to have a very low protein content, but with animal feeding experiments, the protein turned out to be higher quality in terms of biological effect, higher quality than egg yolk protein, which was defined as the perfect protein. So what was happening was that in the juice, there are amino acid, keto acid versions of the essential amino acids, not protein, not even amino acids, but a ketone equivalent. As soon as the body absorbs it, any ammonia that's available can be attached to this keto acid turning it into an essential amino acid. And so what was invisible to chemical analysis suddenly in the body functions, making it a higher quality protein than a perfect protein, just because they weren't able to measure what was present.
And he's asking about the vitamin C content of potatoes?
These people who ate a pure potato diet had no vitamin deficiencies at all.
Interesting.
It isn't just vitamin C, but everything except vitamin B12, they're low in iron too, and vitamin A, mm-hmm. Actual animal form of vitamin A is not there, but other than that, they're a good source of the B vitamins and most of the minerals.
Very interesting. So would this work for russets or the new potatoes or purple potatoes, sweet potatoes, everything, all of them?
They vary quite a bit in composition. Mm-hmm. Sweet potatoes often have carotene that makes it harder to digest, interferes with the enzymes. And the others, some potatoes are very watery, some very starchy. But if it tastes good, basically it's going to have some of that high-quality protein value.
We have a regular guest, Adam Bergstrom. I think you know that he talks about dextrinizing the potatoes. So if you do it at a low temperature, maybe 325, 350, where it takes 2 or 3 hours for a baker, where it actually makes the starch turn more into sugar, more easily digestible.
And they taste good, too.
Oh, they do taste good. And with butter, phew, forget about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's like all you need, man. You're just good. let's see. Boy, we got to burn through them here before we let you go. Can Dr. Pete recommend a certain body weight to serving ratio for eggshell calcium powder? I was interested in finding a safe daily amount to use. So he's wanting to take eggshell calcium, but he wants to know body weight serving. Do you recommend taking eggshell calcium?
It's the next best thing to milk as a source of calcium.
Okay.
Milk and cheese,
mm-hmm.
And then eggshell, and then the next would be oyster shell.
Mm-hmm.
It's calcium carbonate in a very pure form. And if it isn't finely ground, it is irritating to some people's stomachs, so you have to watch out for your reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But in milk drinkers, there's no harm in getting thousands of milligrams of calcium per day. With eggshell, if you had 5,000 milligrams of it, 5 grams would be a pretty massive chunk of eggshell to have going through your intestine.
Yeah,
could be irritating. So I think the effect on your digestion is the main thing, because you're, if you absorb it, then it's going to have an anti-inflammatory effect.
Boy, the people that make those posters that got milk with the white mustache, they must love you, Dr. P.
Probably.
Do you know of anything, here's an email, most effective in regrowing hair lost in people experiencing chronic long-time digestive oil orders? So he thinks the digestive disorders have caused his hair to kind of, do you know anything to regrow those babies?
The anti-stress hormones,
mm-hmm.
all are helpful, but one of the crucial things, you've probably heard the connection between hair loss and heart disease.
Yes.
There is an association, and that's because of the stress hormones. And one of the basic stress producers is the parathyroid hormone interacting with the bones and mitochondria. And it happens that the high parathyroid hormone is very destructive to the hair follicle. And so lowering the parathyroid hormone with vitamin D and calcium in the diet is probably the single most protective thing that can be done, both for heart disease and the hair follicle, because that will help to restore your thyroid function, which helps to restore progesterone, pregnenolone, DHEA, and so on, lower the stress.
And when you mention these different vitamins, Dr. Pete, you're not necessarily
suggesting people run out and start supplementing with these, but we can get a lot of these things from food. Is that correct?
Yeah. When I was teaching nutrition, I had my students think of the simplest foods that you could get all of the nutrients from. And eggs and orange juice, they found that you could get all of your essential nutrients just from those in the right quantities. With milk, eggs, and orange juice, asserted other things, it's very easy to get all of your required vitamins in more than required amounts.
Patricia writes in, can you elaborate on how and why calcium could go rogue and forms and is deposited as harmful plaque and calcifications in the joints?
Exactly the same thing that causes the heart disease and hair loss and so on. The mitochondria are the first thing poisoned by misplaced calcium. And what parathyroid hormone does is to block mitochondria metabolism, turn on lactic acid production. And lactic acid is essential for taking calcium out of your bones where it should be, and in the process it shifts the balance in a way that makes it tend to deposit in soft tissues where it shouldn't be. And parathyroid hormone rises when your diet doesn't have enough vitamin D, calcium, and magnesium, and so increasing your calcium in your diet will lower the parathyroid hormone and protect you against blood vessel calcification and other improper calcifications.
Here's a lady that's looking at taking, she would like to take a little magnesium as well as zinc, but wants to know what your recommendations are, like glycinate or the different zincs or the different magnesiums.
Do you have favorites? I've never heard bad reports from magnesium glycinate, but the only one I've ever used was magnesium carbonate, but that can cause headaches. Apparently some impurity gets into the supplement form. So I rarely recommend any supplement, and I think it's best to get it from pure natural foods.
Right. But magnesium is a reasonable thing for many people?
If you don't get a headache or asthma or diarrhea or something like that from the supplement.
And how about the zinc? If somebody wanted to take zinc for some reason, is there a better kind than others?
Not really. Not zinc. Really. Gluconate is okay, but I don't think doses above 10 milligrams per day are safe.
Oh, so just stay below 10 milligrams for the zinc.
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned a machine to make hydrogenated water.
Yeah, where it's a gas where you can put hydrogen in the water, yes, sir?
I think it would be good if you can have the opportunity to experiment with carbonated water combined with your hydrogen water. Both of those, I think they would work together to restore cell energy.
Really? So in other words, you just get like a carbonated, maybe something like a Perrier or something like that?
Something like that. You can buy cheap supermarket
carbonated
water. The person who discovered oxygen, it was really incidental. He was working on how to carbonate water because they knew in the 18th century that the naturally carbonated mineral water was good for the health. So he was working on making carbon dioxide and accidentally came across oxygen.
So you're thinking if we're going to get one of these machines, which I have, maybe try it with carbonated water too and see if you can feel a difference?
I would bet that it would be about twice as effective.
Really? Wow. What's the science behind that again, just quickly?
Well, Joseph Priestley, who discovered both oxygen and how to make carbonated water, at that time, people quickly put this carbonated water and pure carbon dioxide gas to use in various diseases. They found it alleviated breast cancer, for example, and they described patients who were kept in a relatively healthy condition, healing the ulcer of a cancerous breast, for example. The ulcer would close up when they were exposed to carbon dioxide, so they were giving CO2 enemas and douches and applying it locally to injured tissue. As early as the 1790s, they were writing about its therapeutic properties.
And
the Japanese are currently using it experimentally against cancer.
What do you think about the therapeutic properties just of the hydrogen in general?
There has been very little study of that because it's countercultural.
Countercultural, yeah.
Very, very thin line of research suggesting that we can, our dehydrogenase enzymes that feed energy into the mitochondria probably can assimilate this gaseous hydrogen right from the environment, turning it into energy.
Yeah.
But the amount of research on that has been very thin over the last 50 years.
Yeah. A lot of peer-reviewed studies, though, about the benefits, but so we'll see. People seem to really like it. That's interesting about the carbonated water. I mean, my goodness. That's just real. Double it, you think? Could double the benefits, you think?
I would guess.
Oh, well, that's pretty fun. Well, Dr. Pete, we burned through it here. It's time for you to... What are you going to do the rest of the day?
Oh, I'll probably read.
Probably read. What are you reading these days?
Oh, I'm thinking my next newsletter is something to do with energy and serotonin.
Oh, well, you're always working at it, aren't you, Doc?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good for you. Tell folks about your newsletter before we go. It's you go to raypete.com and they can sign up for that.
To subscribe, it's at Ray Pete's newsletter.
Oh,
at gmail.com.
I'll put that in.
For emailing information on how to subscribe, it's $28 for 2 years every other month.
That's great. $20 for 2 years. You
that's
can't
by
even
email.
That's right. Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll put that into the show page. We so much enjoy you taking the time to join us. You got a lot of fans out there around the world, so I really appreciate you coming on from time to time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sir. Take care of yourself.
Okay,
bye. Wow, what a nice man. Well, I tell you what, he seems to be on it with a lot of stuff, man. I don't know how he remembers all these things, but he does. Well, that's really fun about the carbonated water and the hydrogen. Huh? I will say, though, there's probably a lot more research on it than Dr. Pete is familiar with, and why would he be if he doesn't, you know, he's not researching it, but George says there's just, I don't know, lots and lots of peer-reviewed stuff on it you can get to if you email George. And I'm going to give you, people are asking me for George's email because they have questions, so I'm going to put that George's email on his show page too. Okay, so we will see you tomorrow. I have a lot of fun things to talk about. I've seen some real insights into how I created a situation where a bug could set up a home in my tummy. And we're going to talk about that. So you're going to learn some things tomorrow that I've learned, and I'm going to share them with you just because I love you. And I do, and I'll see you tomorrow. This is Patrick Timpone. May the blessings be.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.